the Maharal Bach, Rabbi Nalevi, Ben Chaviv, was the main nagay, the main opponent to that. The other main point that I mentioned last week was the tremendous impact that the Mekubalim had in Tzfatz. It was a whole center of Mekubalim. Tzfatz became a center of Kabbalah. This became a very important part of Jewish, what should we say, cultural history from that point on. That was one center. And it's interesting that this was really, I would think, since the Churban, this was the first time that Eretz Yisrael begins to play a really important role in the history of Jewish people for about 1,400, 1,500 years. Since the Churban is always a settlement of some type, and a return of some type, Eretz Yisrael, but if you were just Yechidim, Ramban, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, they didn't return to Eretz Yisrael as part of a movement. They didn't start, they really came to Eretz Yisrael toward the end of their, or you might say the end of their careers. And for the first time here, we have many, many very important historical figures all in Eretz Yisrael at the same time. And that's important because of the theme of Golos and Geula that I mentioned permeates all of Jewish history, of course, but especially in the 500 years that we're considering in this course. So in this first century of these 500 years, the century of the 1500s, things are beginning to wake up a little bit in Eretz Yisrael. In terms of the Shulchan Aruch, in terms of the Kabbalah, in terms of Jews beginning slowly but surely to establish communities in Eretz Yisrael. Toward the end of the session last week, I also started to focus on the second main center in Jewish history in that 100 years, the 1500s, and that's Poland. The first time Poland begins to emerge as a new country, for the center of Jewish culture. Jewish culture, of course, I mean Torah, but also today I'm going to mention some other aspects of Jewish culture that become important in those 100 years, the 1500s. Up until this time, Jews had been living in Poland for centuries. When Polish Jewry was destroyed, of course, in World War II, but people talk of 1,000 years of Jewish culture. Because Jews began to settle in Poland, not sure exactly when, but there's traces of a Jewish community there as far back as the 900s. However, it's only a settlement here and there. The first time that Poland begins to emerge as the center, certainly of Ashkenazic Jewry, is in the 1500s. And some of the main names that we mentioned last week are Rabbi Yaakov Palak and Rabbi Shalom Shachna. Both of them are considered predecessors, Rabbeim, or people who had an influence on the Ramah and others. And they were the first to establish yeshivos in Poland. Yeshivos, of course, not in the same sense that we'll be discussing yeshivos later, not in the same sense that we think of yeshivos today as kind of an organized institution, but rather places where they taught Torah, where people came to learn. The most important figure historically, well, is the Rabbi Moshe Isserles, because again of his chibur, the chibur on the Shulchan Aruch, and also because of a couple of other things. We mentioned last week the opposition that Ramah and the Beis Yosef found to the Shulchan Aruch. There were many Gedolei Torah at that time who felt that codifying Torah into a system of a Shulchan Aruch was wrong, and we spoke last week about the Maharshal and his opinions, and especially about the opinions of Rabbeinu Chaim ben Bezalel, who was an older brother of the Maharal near Prague, who had a very strong, vehement opposition to the whole notion of making a Shulchan Aruch. He was a childhood friend of the Ramah. There's all kinds of stories, some are legendary, some are true, about their relationship. But what is true is that he wrote a sefer criticizing the whole approach of the Ramah. And I think toward the end of the session last week, I mentioned specifically some of these approaches, some of these points that of the Ramah's approach that Rabbi Chaim ben Bezalel disapproved of. One was the whole notion of making a Shulchan Aruch. And that traces back to the old dispute that people levied against the Rambam yet, hundreds of years before. How can you take the Torah, which has to be a Gemara-type Torah, Shaklavataria-type Torah, and make it into a Mishnah Torah? That debate was revived when the Mechaber and the Ramah wrote the Shulchan Aruch. That was one of the tainus, one of the criticisms that the Rabbeinu Chaim had. The Rabbeinu Chaim had other criticisms too, especially because the Ramah incorporated a lot of minhagim in his sefer, something that the Rambam hardly ever does. You know, the Rambam does do it sometimes. He's not the Chanukah one of the times that he does. But that's rare. And the Ramah, as you know, from turning any learning any siman in Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah constantly brings down minhagim as opposed to dinim. And the Ramah also introduces concepts that uses very widespread concepts in halacha that usually were very rarely used. Concepts like hefsed merubah, like certain things being usur, but in cases of hefsed merubah, of great loss, they become mutar. Or b'shas hapchak, or the eis hatzorech. These kinds of concepts you don't find in svarim before the Ramah. Well, you, I shouldn't say you don't find them. You rarely find them. You don't find them used as much as Ramah uses them. And Rabbi Chaim said, "Memonafshach, if he's writing a sefer in which he's writing what's osur and what's mutar, all right, fine. Although I have things against the two, but to write a sefer and to say yesh machmirim and chen yesh linhog, but makam hatchak, you can be mekel, that Rabbi Chaim opposed very much. I mentioned just for your own interest, if you want to follow up some of the writings on this whole approach, which has to do with the whole way horo'ah, paskening shilas, is done. And if you want to look more, know more about this controversy, the Ramah against Rabbi Chaim ben Bezalel and others, there's a sefer by the Maharat Chayes. Maharat Chayes has a sefer called Kol Kitzvei Maharat Chayes. And in the Kol Kitzvei Maharat Chayes, there's a sefer called Darchei Horo'ah, where he looks at this. I'm not going to go into now into the Horo'ah aspect of it, but just historically, it's a very fascinating document. Maharat Chayes, by the way, didn't live until the 1800s. He writes back about this old machlokas in the 1500s. Yeah. I don't know offhand if he even addressed the Rambam on the tour, but he probably referred back to the old opposition against the Rambam. We don't find too much opposition against the tour, but against the Rambam, certainly there was that opposition. And by the time Rabbeinu Chaim came around, he felt that if the Rambam did his work, fine. But we don't have to continue. We can use the Rambam as a source. But to continue the whole process, he was against it. Today I'm going to be speaking about the Maharal a little bit. And the Maharal was, what should we say? He was not too, he was plenty critical of the Rambam. Maharal felt in many ways that the Rambam did some things that he didn't agree with. And we'll talk about that. Whether his brother of Chaim Kalashita or not, I really don't know. The only sefer that I'm familiar with myself of the Rabbeinu Chaim ben Bezalel is a sefer called Sefer HaChaim. It's the name of the sefer. And it's a Musa sefer. It's a very, very beautiful sefer, a little sefer. That shows you that the Maharal's big brother also had a lot to offer. Interestingly, in history, this is one of those examples of an older brother being overshadowed by a younger brother. Kind of like the Rashbam and Rabbeinu Tam. And the Rashbam is Rabbeinu Tam's older brother. And yet, both obviously Gedolei Rishonim, but somehow Rabbeinu Tam, at least in history, is a bigger figure. It's always hard to know, of course, how you measure greatness. But in this place, it's easy for us, because we're just talking about historically who made the biggest impact. Certainly there's no comparison between the Maharal and the brother of Rabbeinu Chaim. Yeah. When did the Rishon? When the Yonah was the Rishon. Before our time. All right. The Rabbi Yonah, you know, earlier in his life was a misnaget of the Rambam too. And there's a whole lot to say about that. But Rabbi Yonah lived probably in the 1200s. I also mentioned last week the Marshal, the brother of the Maharal, and the Maharal himself. I just briefly mentioned. I'd like to devote some time today to discussion of the Maharal, because the Maharal was a central figure in this time, who had, I hope to show as time goes on, there are often people who are historically important in their time, but who are even more important when you look at the influence they had down the road. Right. There's no question that the main people we've been talking about until now, the Shulchan Aruch, Beis Yosef, and the Ramah, had an influence on their own generations. And I tried to stress that the Torah became, the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, the unit called the Shulchan Aruch, became a historical force, keeping the people together, keeping the people uniform in a certain way, and that was the Ramah's reason, perhaps, for stressing minhag and for stressing certain chumras, because these were ways he had of binding the people together, and that was important. There's also no question that the Mechaber and the Ramah continued to have an influence, obviously, right down to today, right? I'm not sure, but usually on this table is the Shulchan Aruch, and obviously it's an ongoing influence. The Maharal was important in his time, but was perhaps more important because of the ongoing influence that he had at a few important points in Jewish history of these 500 years. First, let's take a look at his time itself. We have to back up a little bit and talk a little bit about general history, not Jewish history, and two terms, one that I always stumble on. I think I got it right this time. There are at least two things, going on in Europe during the 1500s, and in general, among the Goyim. And it had a number of ways an influence upon Jewish history. Two things I'd like to mention are the Renaissance. Renaissance is a fancy word that means rebirth, because during this time, there was a rebirth of culture, philosophy, a liberal way of thinking. It was called a rebirth because the way historians look at it is that once upon a time there was the wonderful Greek culture and Greek philosophy and poetry and a more liberal, humanistic way of looking at the world. And then the world entered Dark Ages, which began 500, 600, but extended through into 1100, 1200, 1300, till toward the end of the 1400s, and then by the 1500s, is a rebirth. And the Gentile world is emerging from this dark period and rediscovering the light. And therefore, in areas like philosophy, literature, art, and music, there are new developments in the general culture called the Renaissance. The main philosophical difference between the Renaissance time, the 1500s and before, is the growth of a philosophy of humanism. Humanism means... But it's new, and it's a rebirth. It's a Renaissance. That's why it's called rebirth, a rebirth of what was. Whether all this is true, in other words, whether it was really a rebirth or something new. I mean, I'll leave that to a general history course. But what's important for us to know here is that there was this period of